Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. What are your thoughts about the current election campaign? Feeling a bit jaded, are we? Well, this evening we intend to revive your flagging spirits, to restore your faith in politics. Richard Harries is the former Anglican Bishop of Oxford and currently sits in the House of Lords as Lord Harries of Pentregrath. As a writer and commentator, he's been part of English public life for many years. Richard Dawkins, High Priest of the New Atheists, chose Richard Harries as one of those he felt he could have a reasonable discussion with about matters of faith. And most recently, Lord Harries presented the Sarum Lectures, entitled Faith in Politics, subtitled Rediscovering the Christian Roots of Our Political Values. The lectures offer a reflection for both believers and unbelievers alike on the nature of the body politic and the quest for the good society. Lord Harries, welcome to Sunday Night.
Good evening. Thank you very much.
Well, you've just had an election campaign, and we're in the midst of one, both for different reasons, reflect uncertainty. Both share the foundational shock of the global financial crisis, and in England you've had the parliamentary expenses scandal, and here in Australia the governing party removing their own prime minister for internal political reasons. And I guess also in America, public faith in Obama has plummeted recently. Responses to these shocks are causing some to question the very nature of the system. Is this in part why you presented the lectures and wrote the book?
Indeed it is, because it's important that the title on my book is Faith in Politics? And behind that title is a sense that in England or Great Britain, people have not only lost faith in politics, there's a lack of confidence in our political values. And I do believe that we need passionately to believe in our political way of life, in democracy, the rule of law, equality, liberty, and so on. So that's one of the major theses of this book. We must recover a sense of the value of our political system. And the other aspect of it, which is in the subtitle, Rediscovering the Christian Roots of Our Political Values. A lot of people think that our modern democratic system is entirely an invention of the 17th century secular enlightenment. I try to show, actually, on the contrary, many of those enlightenment thinkers were Christians, and our political way of life is actually deeply embedded in our Christian culture and our Christian values.
In following those two strands, you address two communities throughout the book. The underlying argument is about the nature of democracy and the good society generally, but you also address believers directly, particularly in the first couple of chapters, and I'd like to talk about that specifically for a moment. Recently we had on the program a believing Christian activist for many of the points you clearly support, Ron Sider, author of Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. Sider is one of those who suggests that Christians, whilst being social activists and working for reform, should be wary of electoral politics because of the compromises it brings with the world. Now, this is a critical point for you. In fact, in some ways, it's a starting point, a necessary starting point. This how we relate to the world and what is the nature of God's relationship to the world and us.
Absolutely. And there is a fundamental difference of starting point between Ronald Sider and myself. I deeply respect his position because it begins with an awareness of the radical nature of the teaching of Jesus. And he basically thinks that we have to take that with the utmost seriousness, with no compromise allowed at all. My starting point is the New Testament as a whole and the Christian sense at that time that Christians are living between the times. They're living between the time of the inauguration of the kingdom of God on earth with Christ's death and his resurrection and the present with us of the Holy Spirit and its consummation in glory at the end of all time. And it seems to me so long as we're conscious of living between the times, we have to do justice both to the radical teaching of Jesus, and it really is very radical, but also to the fact that, for example, so long as we live in this world, we need a police force, because society doesn't simply hold together on the basis of persuasion and goodwill. There are nasty people around, and unfortunately societies have to use coercion. Now, it seems to me Ronald Sider doesn't want to get into that business at all, where we face up to the fact that so long as human communities exist, we have to have a level of coercion to hold those communities together. Very sadly, we need police, a criminal justice system, and prisons, very, very sadly.
And as you point out, the very nature of Christians recognizing that engagement as what has given Christianity its vitality and power over the years to actually shape a world.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think we can talk about it also in very, very simple terms. Jesus said that we're to love our neighbours as ourselves, and indeed that's at the heart of the ethical teaching of all the major religions of the world. Now, for much of human history, it was possible to love your neighbour simply at a personal level, or you could get together with other people and found a hospital or a hospice or a home for orphans or whatever it might be. And, of course, much of European history, even today, reflects the fact that Christians have got together with other people of goodwill and founded our great hospices, hospitals, schools, and so on. But ever since the 1418 war in Europe, the state has taken over so many of those traditional functions, welfare and education, for example. And it seems to me you can't love your neighbour today without taking into account the political policies which will bear upon and affect your neighbour for good and for ill. And it seems to me that if we're to take seriously the injunction to love your neighbour as yourself, some kind of interaction with the political realm is absolutely inescapable.
That you must choose to get your hands dirty.
Absolutely. And politics, as we know, is the art of the possible.
Yes, and as many commentators in various ways have said since Machiavelli, dissimulation is an essential part of the art.
Yeah, well, I think it's possible to have more integrity than that. I mean, I believe that there are people of real integrity in politics, and I don't think it's all full of criminals and rogue and dissemblers.
I'm not suggesting that, but I am suggesting that... I think the expenses scandal is a very good example of that, and you use that as a paradigm, that there are people who abuse trust in the expenses scandal.
Yeah.
There are those who made political capital out of the expenses scandal,
yes.
And there are those who followed through with integrity during that scandal. And that seems to be a paradigm for our general discomfort with politics at the moment, that when somehow we've lost faith in the totality of the system, that expenses scandal betokens something else in the body politic.
You're absolutely right, but I would widen it out beyond the body politic to society as a whole. I think what the expenses scandal in Britain revealed is that there were a good number of people who thought that if they simply followed the rules, which were very ambiguous, and interpreted them as loosely as possible, it would be all right. There seemed to be a lack of a sense of honour. That, I think, is what has gone. And I think for too long now, at least in Europe, people have thought that if it's legal, it's good enough. If it's legal, we can get away with it. And what I actually feel passionately about is that without in any way downplaying the importance of what is legal or illegal, we need to recover a much deeper and stronger sense of wider moral values. If you like, a moral environment, a moral milieu. And I don't know whether Michael Sandel's work has been influential in Australia at all. He came and did the Reith Lectures in Britain, and he made quite an impact, and he certainly made quite an impact on me. And I think what he shows is that because of 1960s, extreme libertarianism, where everybody makes up their own values, has simply come into a cul-de-sac, and we've actually got to work together as a society to find a much stronger, more cohesive sense of common values.
I'd like to come to that in a moment. There's one other before we leave the expenses scandal. You mentioned the way in which there seemed to be a divorce between what was honourable or ethical, in another phrase, and what was legal. And there's a sense in which there's a paradox there as well, because that very focus on the narrowly legal has been brought about in the last 20 or 30 years, certainly by those who've also been advocates of strict legalism, the black letter law school, which claims to itself some sense of morality or moral entitlement. That is, we are the ones who are constructing the law or interpreting the law in a very strict sense. And it's a sort of loaded interpretation because it leaves aside the question of the intent of the law.
Yes, well, I mean, law is a very sort of complex issue, one of the things I try to do in the book is recover a much richer, if you like, more ancient sense of law. We tend to view law these days in very pragmatic terms, like as though all laws were simply like driving on the left-hand side or the right-hand side of the road, simply a matter of public convenience that we all do the same thing. I try to argue for a much richer sense of law as ultimately embedded in the divine wisdom, the divine ordering of the universe, and our ability to participate in this through the use of our reasonable minds, through the use of our intelligence. We can, as it were, participate in the divine wisdom and the divine ordering of things. Now, I think that puts law in a much wider moral context. I think good law is ultimately grounded in morality. If you take, for instance, international human rights laws, very important, I think, to see these, not just simply in terms of positivism, you know, this is what certain states have agreed to do at a certain time, but actually they're grounded in fundamental values about the dignity and value of human beings. And in the same way that law is embedded in value, I think that it has its place within a wider context of a moral environment.
Our guest on Sunday night, Richard Harries, former Bishop of Oxford, and sits in the House of Lords as Lord Pentagarth. You're on Sunday night, John Cleary with you. Lord Harries, let's speak for a moment now about the deeper questions which you've raised in your book. You suggest first that you wanted to remind people that the very system we inhabit comes to us from a deep tradition, and that tradition comes out of a Judeo-Christian and Roman tradition which is deeply infused with an ethical and a moral sense. It comes out of a sense of values, and those values precede, as you say, the Enlightenment. Take us back to what you see as the key foundational roots, if you like, of the system we have today.
Well, I think let's start with a Christian understanding of what it is to be a human being in society. One of the people who've influenced me very greatly is the American thinker Reinhold Niebuhr, who was an influence on a whole range of top American academics and politicians, including President Obama, interestingly enough. And Reinhold Niebuhr wrote a brilliant book called The Children of Light and the Children of Darkness, arguing from a Christian point of view in favor of what we would call liberal democracy. And he has this wonderful statement. He says that man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible. Man's inclination to injustice makes democracy necessary. Now, I think that expresses a Christian understanding of what it is to be a human being in society, that, to put it in very explicitly Christian terms, we're all made in the image of God, if you like, in the image of Christ, but we're all crucifiers of Christ. And if we're in organizing the political system, we have to do justice both those inclinations.
It also goes to another of his famous aphorisms: the doctrine of original sin is the only empirically verifiable doctrine of the Christian faith.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I think this is one of the great strengths about a Christian understanding of life, is that it does take that dark side of human life very, very seriously, and therefore it is opposed to all sentimental and unrealistic utopianism. But at the same time, I think, and this is where I go back to Ronald Sider, whom you mentioned earlier on, I think as Christians we must still do justice to the very radical teaching of Jesus. We mustn't betray that. We must continually be, as it were, haunted by that and beckoned by it. For me, I think a very simple and straightforward example is when Jesus said that we are to forgive not seven times, but 77 times seven. What does this mean in society? Does this mean that we are to abolish the police and the whole judicial system, as Tolstoy apparently thought? Or does it mean we ignore it altogether and simply put up with the fact that life is hard and that's the sort of thing we have to do? If we take the radical teaching of Jesus seriously, it will acknowledge, of course, from a realistic point of view, from the point of view of original sin, we have to have a judicial system. But at the same time, we will never give up on anybody. We will have prisons which always have in mind the fundamental dignity and value of people in prison and their potential rehabilitation. So the teaching of Jesus must impinge on every aspect of public life, even though it's never possible, I think, it's not usually possible in the political realm to give, as it were, a total expression to the fullness of that radical thrust of his teaching.
The other thing you point out linked to this is that our laws, those things that govern the way we operate in society, are couched and spring out of an ethical framework that is profoundly communitarian.
Yes, I do indeed feel that. And I'm glad you picked that up, John, because I think that since the 17th century, at least in Europe, we have had a very false and distorted, over-individualistic view about what it means to be a human being. We tend to think of human life as made up of a whole series of individuals, whereas actually even from a straightforward realistic point of view, we know that mind is a social reality, that we become persons only in and through our relationships with other persons.
Yes, and that we evolved as beings in groups.
We evolved as beings in relationship to other human beings, both as a species, but also as a baby. I mean, when we see babies begin to talk because they're talked to by their parents and others, and as they begin to learn to talk outside themselves, they learn to talk inside themselves from what we call more thinking. But it's a fundamentally interactive process right from the beginning. And I think the African, traditional African society has a much greater sense of this, a much truer sense. I think they use the word Ubuntu, which means sort of life is always life together, always life in communion with other persons. And actually, of course, from a specifically Christian point of view, this is some kind of reflection of what we think of ultimate being or reality of God, who is persons in relationship.
You suggest that hindsight has done some damage in this arena. That is, where we read people like John Locke and Adam Smith through a highly refined individualistic prism, which they did not share.
I think that it may be that some of those thinkers probably did have a fairly individualistic view, but I think I'd want to go back earlier than that. Some of those thinkers were, of course, profoundly Christian, and one important point is John Locke, who's usually regarded as the sort of fountainhead of religious liberty in Western society, because he argued for religious liberty on fundamentally Christian grounds. He said that unless faith is freely and genuinely chosen, it's not faith at all. It's a Christian argument in favour of religious liberty. But I think I would want to perhaps go back a little. I think that individualism was creeping in, even with people like John Locke and Adam Smith. One would think would probably need to go back a little bit earlier than that.
Perhaps the Reformation, perhaps people like Calvin as well. The Reformation must have an influence there.
Absolutely. So I think we need really to go back to a more biblical view. I don't know when this individualism grew up. It may have grown up much more in the sort of late medieval period, or began to do that. But we need to recover much more biblical sense, I think, of life in community.
Take us through that the way theology and politics interact in your view in that period. You mentioned that we've become a much more individualized group, and you do trace some religious roots to the origins of present day democracy through people like Locke and others.
Yes, I mean if you take some of our sort of fundamental political values like equality, liberty, fraternity or life together. The great sort of slogan of the French Revolution, equality, liberty, and life together, as I would translate it. If you look at each of those values, they're all deeply embedded in a Christian understanding of what it is to be a human being in society. Equality, for example, from a Christian point of view, we believe that all human beings are of equal worth and dignity in the heart and mind of God. And we can't simply leave that as an abstract little piece of speculation or a little bit of pious notion. If we actually believe it, that has to be translated in some way into the political order. And bit by bit, In the evolution of political life in the West, this has been so. And one obvious way now is one person, one vote. Not more than one, not less than one, one person, one vote. We are absolutely equal in having one vote. When we go into shops, everybody, in a sense, has an equal choice. But, and here, of course, is the big flaw, the French Revolution people thought that if you did away with all the old restrictions on human liberty, somehow equality would come as well, because we know that's not happened, that although we've achieved a lot of political equality, in fact, because of the dominance of the market in human life now at the moment, there are gross and growing inequalities. But to go back to your fundamental question, things like equality and liberty, just to take those, and human fraternity, I argue that those are deeply rooted in our Christian understanding of what it is to be a human being in society.
What do you say to those who say, well, no, you don't need that. You can actually construct a secular ethics that doesn't need any religious underpinning. Those values can be teased out of a simple sense of human obligation. You don't need to have those religious roots.
Well, John, that's a very good and, of course, a teasing question. And without wanting to plug a book, that's a previous book I wrote sort of last year called The Reenchantment of Morality. I tried to address that, because you're absolutely right. A lot of people today do arrive at values like equality, like religious liberty, like human community, on an entirely secular basis. And my own view is that we shouldn't denigrate this. We shouldn't downplay it. Good values should be recognized and rejoiced in wherever they are, because all goodness ultimately comes from God. So I have no real difficulty about that. Secondly, I think I would also want to argue that many of these values, which people now champion on a secular basis, have actually entered our culture through our Christian history, our Christian and our Christian tradition. And I think a very big question and an unanswerable question is, if there is a decline in the influence of the Christian faith in our society, how long will it be possible for these values simply to be sustained on a secular basis? The Nobel Prize-winning poet Seamus Heaney said once that he thought that our society was kind of living on its unconscious past as far as moral values are concerned, and he wondered whether his grandchildren would in fact have the same sense of values, or whether somehow things might have run into the sand by then. Well, now, that's a kind of question we can't answer, of course, but I think it's a very important question to actually pose.
Yes, is it in some ways a reason why Pope Benedict chose very early in his papacy to take on the question of European civilization?
Yes, I think that's a very, very good point. European civilization, it's wonderful artistic and cultural heritage, which everybody rejoices in, though not everybody acknowledges the Christian aspect of it. But also, that was sort of integrally linked with a particular understanding of what it is to be a human being in society, made in the image of God on this life in order to grow in his likeness, not alone, but together with other people. That is our European civilization. But I think where Pope Benedict can be misinterpreted, if it's thought that this somehow excludes Islam and Muslims, because one of the big debates in Europe at the moment is the presence of Islam, the contribution of Islam to European civilization through its science, through its maths, and through its other cultural features, and also the contribution which Muslims are making in so many countries today, notably Great Britain and France, but also Germany and elsewhere. So I wouldn't want to interpret this in a narrowly Christian way, but a Christian, but an inclusive Christianity, if you like.
Richard Harries is our guest on Sunday night, former Bishop of Oxford and now in the House of Lords. Richard Harries is author of Faith in Politics, Rediscovering the Christian Roots of Our Political Values. You mentioned Richard Harries in your book. You suggest that the Catholic tradition has preserved an understanding of community, that Protestantism in some way lost or didn't grasp hold of as firmly, and this explains in some ways the difference between the Americans and the Europeans and their sensibilities on these matters.
Yes, I mean, it's the strength of Protestantism, of course, is the emphasis upon individual responsibility and individual accountability, and I certainly wouldn't want to downplay that, and that's been responsible for a great deal of the strength of, first of all, the industrialized and then the modern West, the sort of go-getting nature of it. But I think that you can still see what we've lost if you go to a country today which is predominantly Catholic. For instance, just recently I was visiting Spain, a little town called Murcia, and we happened to arrive at the time of the Corpus Christi procession. Everybody was processing through the streets, and what was wonderful, all up the equivalent of the main shopping malls in England, sort of Regent Street or Oxford Street, there were little shrines which were maintained by a particular guild of people. One I particularly liked was an altar, and on the altar they had a very well-carved statue of Martha serving Jesus with a loaf of bread. Martha, not the traditional sort of Mary, who's usually the heroine of that story. And in front of it were six men with staves, and I discovered that this was the Society of Hoteliers and Restaurateurs. They thought it was entirely natural that they should have an altar in the main shopping mall, that they should take part in this Corpus Christi procession. In other words, this was something that involved the whole community. And I think what's really sad about the Reformation is that really it destroyed that popular religion. Now, you may say it's religion of a rather low level, but I think there is loss with that, as well as gain, of course, on the emphasis of individual responsibility.
Yes, well, your sort of low-level religion is not simply confined to sort of the Catholic Mediterranean arena. One only has to go to the Protestant variety and see the supermarket mall sort of religion that creeps across in the prosperity gospel. So I guess there are things lost on both sides in that equation. Let's talk for a moment about individualism, though, and the way in which individualism has taken on a particular meaning since, as you point out, the 17th century, that shed its communitarian roots in a way which has become damaging to the very nature of the civil society in which we're in today.
Yes, I think certain societies are more damaged than others. I think a lot depends upon the society in which one was living. I mean, just recently I went to visit our daughter in France, and we went out with her one evening to a little town nearby. And in the sort of public gardens there, half the town seemed to be out enjoying traditional dancing, a mixture of French traditional dancing and Brazilian traditional dancing. They had a sort of mixed band. Now, it seemed to me to be a much stronger sense of people belonging together in French society than in British society, because of the emphasis there upon the state, which we haven't got, for instance, in America, and haven't got either, I think, in Britain. So I can't comment on Australia, but I think that societies do vary very, very greatly in the extent to which they have actually fostered community, both at a local level and at wider levels. In Britain at the moment, David Cameron is trying to get back to something of this in his talk about the big society. It's a terrible vague phrase, but I think what he means is that he wants to get away from the polarization which has been so apparent over the last 50 years between the state on the one hand and in the individual, and to emphasize what Edmund Burke called the little platoons of society, all the intermediate organizations and communities between the state and the individual, which the most obvious are, of course, the schools and local community associations.
The real question we have to ask in the midst of that discussion, though, is have those institutions, those little institutions, the small platoons, crumbled to such an extent over the last 50 or 60 years, and not just under the weight of the state, but crumbled for all sorts of various reasons. Some social commentators would say it's the rise of materialism, it's just simply the television culture or whatever. There's been a crumbling of those institutions to the extent that they simply will not be able to pick up what David Cameron is expecting of them, and people will begin to fall through the cracks in quite a massive way.
Well, first of all, I think that it would be quite wrong for the state to shuffle off its proper responsibilities, and we need to be quite clear about what the state's proper responsibilities are. But if we take the voluntary organisations, first of all, there are literally millions of people who do engage in voluntary activity at least once or twice a month, at least in Britain. The voluntary sector is still alive and well, I'm very glad to say. And the voluntary sector, I think, does have particular advantages over the state. It can be much more sensitive at local level to particular local needs, for example. It can be less bureaucratic. It can be swifter moving. So I think there are lots of essential features about the whole sort of voluntary movement, if one can put it there, which should not be used as an excuse for the state to give up its proper responsibilities, but which does have a very proper complementary role to play.
Richard Harris, we've only a little time left. Let me ask you about the other big factor that you mentioned, and that is the way in which multiculturalism is profoundly changing our societies, and many people say the response to an appropriate response to that is to invent a new cultural myth, to basically forget those deep associations with a particular religious tradition and sort of establish a year zero somewhere from which we are all now new people, new individuals in a healthy multicultural society. Whilst philosophically it may be appealing, it has little hope of acquiring any bite with any sort of social reality.
Yeah.
Others are saying, no, there are deep clefts here that we must recognise, and we must give societies time to adjust and adopt ways of looking, speaking and acting amongst ourselves that pay due recognition to those traditions, but also at the same time know when to draw the line, when to say, no, that part of the tradition is outside of the framework, this part is inside.
I think one of the very helpful phrases that's emerged in the last few years is that of multiple identities. For instance, I regard myself as Welsh, but a British citizen, a Christian by religion, and a European by culture. Those are all parts of my identity. I don't know whether it got as far as Australia, but in England a few years ago, what was called the Norman Tebbit cricket test became big news. He posed the question, which cricket team do you support? That's a real test of your of where you feel you belong.
It's called dog whistle politics in Australia.
Right, but I mean, I think the important thing about identity, that of course there are certain things that are given, but we can also in part construct our own identities. And I think identity is a living, growing thing. It's changing. And clearly we are in a process of changing. And the important thing to me is question is, what is the role of the state in this? Now, I think the state does have a role. I think in Britain it has a role, for example, in the new citizenship ceremonies. Apparently these have been quite a success. New immigrants now have to learn certain things about British history and pass a test, and they have to take an oath of loyalty to the Queen and to our Constitution. I think this is all right. But British citizenship is different from, let us say, having an Asian ethnic background, and there's absolutely no incompatibility with having that and being a British citizen. But I think the important point is that identity is not something which is fixed and final. It has changed, it is changing, it will change more, and it's a natural process. And I think we're evolving into something. The state has a role, but not only the state, in this evolution of this new kind of identity.
Ian Herson Ali has recently been in Australia, and she suggested that one of the difficulties of, particularly in, say, Holland and other societies which she grew up in as a young Muslim, is that whilst the society is prepared to stand by its multiculturalism, it doesn't know where to draw the boundaries. And she suggested that there are some areas of conservative Islam, for example, which are incompatible with other provisions of universality, such as things in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And that whilst we need to privilege individuals, cultural relativism shouldn't go to the extent of privileging institutions or organisations or ways of doing things, that we must recognise that where they conflict with the individual, we've got to move to the side of the individual.
Yes, I mean, I think she's right in that there are certain aspects of Islam as practiced by certain people which are a fundamental denial of human rights, and where there's a choice there's no doubt about it, we have to choose human rights over a particular religious perspective. But it's quite wrong, of course, to label all Muslims or the whole Islamic world in that kind of way. I mean, Holland seems at the moment to be a particularly polarized society on this issue. And although in England, of course, we've had radical extremists who've engaged in violence, I think that we're not actually as a society as polarized as they are in Holland. But no, I mean, she's absolutely right that there are certain fundamental moral values which are expressed, for example, in human rights, which must take priority over other things, over, for instance, the terrible primitive custom of female circumcision, over forced marriages. I think there can be no question of allowing any of those traditional customs, which, of course, are not Islamic, under the guise of multiculturalism.
Yes, and, of course, equally, we could point to some very conservative Christian traditions, which we may be caused to say, well, actually, we need to think twice about whether they fit within the frame or not. I mean, it's not something about Islam, as you point out.
It's not something about Islam. Of course it isn't. But that, of course, is where what's in the news at the moment, and which we're in Europe, people having to face.
So where finally do we go? We recognise that we have a heritage which we must own, that in somehow that heritage shapes the laws and customs, that laws do not float free, but nevertheless we have to be sufficiently flexible about that framework, about that broad framework, to allow for dynamic change. It's a very big ask of people, and it's happening ever more quickly.
Yes, I mean, that's very well put. And I think, just to repeat very briefly something I've said before, that in the construction of what we might first of all call this new moral environment, which I do think we desperately need in Europe, people's values, if they're good values, should be recognised and championed as such, whoever puts them forward, whether it's a secularist or a Muslim. Those should be recognised and we should celebrate. But in addition to that, I think that Christians will want to point out that our history, our tradition, have shaped the culture which we have got and have contributed enormous richness and strength to it. And so much of what we take for granted actually can only be properly understood within a Christian framework. For instance, our Christian understanding of what it is to be a human being in society, that we all have this potential for good, we all have this potential for evil, and somehow we have to construct societies which does justice to both aspects of that and doesn't ignore one or the other.
Richard Harries, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks for giving us of your time this evening. Richard Harries, author of Faith in Politics, Rediscovering the Christian Roots of Our Political Values. Thanks so much for joining us. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.